MinRes ticked up the bond offering up from US $850 million that we talked about the other day. It's gone up to 1.1. Let the spitballing begin, JD.
I want to put a bit of a punt out there.
Word on the decline going around about something with Gina for this lithium superco. Gina could keep accumulating Liontown shares for pretty much the next 3 months. Is she looking to partner with Albemarle? Is she looking to vote against Albemarle? Will Chris Ellison and MinRes become player alongside Gina? Righto, Money Miners, the end of the week is here, Friday 29th of September. Today, bit of happening. We've got Liontown CapEx increase, MinRes. We've got to put we didn't talk about them yesterday, JD, but they've... this is new. This is new. They've increased the bond. It's just fucking MinRes every day. Increase the bonds. We've got ACG SPAC.
Yep, the London-listed SPAC whose deal has fallen over. They won't be happy. Maybe they will be.
LPI, Lithium Power International, looking to be possibly acquired by the Chilean state-owned Codelco.
Yep, that's right.
Said that right, haven't I?
You sure have, mate.
ISO Energy Merger, Sovereign and Core Lithium's up a bit too.
Awesome.
Let's get into it, mate. Sponsors for the day. Anytime Exploration Services, Seamus and Victoria Murphy, the OG sponsors, mate. Look. Anything exploration, recruitment, labour hire, vehicles, soil sampling, but not just exploration, mining as well. JD, you know what I like about Seamus in Victoria?
They've got decades of experience in the industry, mate.
20 plus years, and the best thing about dealing with them, I deal with them. There's no HR. They are HR. They are marketing. They're the judge, jury, executioner.
Yep, work directly with the owners, eh?
Yep, and that's what'll happen if you want to deal with Anytime Exploration. So give them a buzz for anything.
Awesome.
Exploration.
Cheers, Anytime.
Love your work. Righto, JD, what's going on? MinRes ticked up the bond offering up from US $850 million that we talked about the other day. It's gone up to 1.1.
Yeah, 1.1 US billion. So they've ticked that up a lazy 250 million. They're going to be paying 9.25%. So that was at the higher end. But, I mean, I've got two comments to make on this, Matty. The first one is what should we read into them ticking it up? So we spoke, I think it was on Monday, that they announced they'd be issuing 850 million. And now they've done a bit of a global roadshow. They've been speaking with investors all around the world. They're ticking it up. That shows to me that there's demand and they've got the backing to go and do whatever their plans are. Mm. We know Chris likes to keep those ones close to his chest.
Did they say – they didn't say 9.25 the other day.
They did not, no. So right. That is the coupon rate they're going to be paying by 2028 is the expiry on these ones. So the second takeaway that I have is not specific to MinRes, but just reflective of the interest rate environment we're in. So for so long we were always hearing about this zero interest rate environment, Matty, and it just really goes to show that the world has changed. Equity investors, you know, they're tossing up, and, you know, more broader-based investors who look at various classes of assets are looking at where can I get return. And now you're seeing 9.25% in corporate debt, so that's, you know, high up on the capital structure at a company like MinRes. We saw CommBank, obviously a bit out of our depth here, talking about a financial company, but they're offering corporate bonds of just under 7%. They're pretty strong, compelling returns, you know. Obviously, the interest rates have gone up, but it just makes the sort of weighing up of an equity investment versus the likes of these ones that much harder to make when you know you can get a pretty compelling return from top-notch businesses.
And I suppose if you look at the size of this bond, and as you said, it's a bond, so it's lower on the risk profile for the lender, the people that are going to buy the bond. So, you know, 9.25% it sounds high, but we're comparing it to when we're in that zero interest rate environment. So that is on the lower end of what we're seeing today.
Yeah, 9.25%, Matty, that's a pretty compelling return, and it means when you're assessing an equity investment, you want it to be pretty knockout to reach that hurdle.
Mm, right, so haven't stipulated what specifically they're spending it on. But this is our job to spitball the ideas and
general corporate expenses, mate.
General corporate and expenses.
And CapEx.
Yeah. So, let's let the spitballing begin, JD. So,
get the big one out the way first, Matty. But Bald Hill, that's not going to cost them. I'd be shocked if it cost them this much money. They're talking about buying the debt. I mean, we've seen no real terms around what that deal looks like. But I would be really, really shocked if this money's gone toward that. Maybe a small portion. But
yeah, because wasn't the initially when they were talking about it, it was apparently it was going to be worth around $1 billion. But now they're in administration. Are you saying that because they're in administration, they're going to get picked up for a lot? They're going to pick that asset up for a lot cheaper?
Well, they were talking about buying the debt of the company. So I think what you're referencing there is what the value of the actual business was. And again, it's a really quirky situation to find yourself in when a company has become more valuable in the time in which it's been in administration. So that aside, I want to put a bit of a punt out there. We'd spoken about this before the show. Strike Energy.
Strike.
So they've got a market cap of roughly $1 billion, a bit over $1 billion, I think. They've had
over $1 billion Aussie, yeah.
Yeah, and they've had a terrific performance over the past couple years. I saw a good announcement earlier this week or maybe late last week from the company. And yeah, I mean, just in terms of dollar values, they've raised US 1.1, chuck on a bit of a premium.
And we remember the history with MinRes and Gina going for Norwest.
Exactly. We know Ellison is no stranger to gas. He's spoken about his interest to be involved in it, have it power his various other operations. So who's to say? I mean, looking at the lithium assets, unless they're going and buying something completely out of left field, it's not going to go towards Wodgina. It's not going to go toward Mount Marion. So that's a bit of an out there punt.
And if you look at the number, so you said Striker at a bit over $1 billion Aussie, chuck a 30% premium on a takeover premium on top of that, takes them, you know, 1.3, 1.4 if it goes up. 1.1 US is about bit over 1.4 Aussie.
The numbers just line up, don't they?
The number does really line up with that value of Strike.
So okay.
We'll see. Then look, as I said, lithium M&A is, and we'll get into it next. You're not rule out organic growth within their current operations, but look, there is the possible word on the decline going around about something with Gina for this lithium superco.
Yeah, that's the other one we've got to mention, and it sort of makes sense to talk about that as we talk about Liontown.
Yeah, so we'll weave it all together perfectly at the end as per usual. I will not go off on a tangent. So Liontown have come out today with an announcement saying their CapEx has gone up, which had been predicted by analysts. Capital cost of first production has been lifted from $895 million, which was announced in January this year. It's gone up to $951 million, so up 60 mil or so. Canaccord, they modelled a predicted CapEx of $920 million recently, which indicated there was still about a $300 mil funding gap. So it's up another 30. So that would indicate, based on their model, there's a $330 mil funding gap. So I guess the money miners want to know how the funding gap is predicted. So they had Liontown had $305 million cash at the end of the June quarter. They got $182 million undrawn from their Ford loan facility, and they're predicting DSO cash flow of around $90 million. So, but there's also a possible $300 million worth of export credit agency loans at Liontown. Liontown received a non-binding joint letter of support in early August. So these were from three separate Australian, US and Korean ECA agencies, export credits agencies. So they were proposing to chip in for that $300 mil, but these are drawn from in mid-2024. So it doesn't look like that will fill that funding gap before production. So, and they were non-binding. So if you're based on the June cash, the Ford facility, from today's announcement, they said they're not planning to sell the DSO. They're going to stockpile. They do have the ability to still sell it. So let's scrap that $90 million DSO. That'd put it at a funding gap off those numbers of $460 million at the moment. And that's not including the potential $300 million of export credit agency loans. So I guess what were the drivers behind the CapEx increase? Mining and processing contract rates, obviously the Byrnecut contract coming a little bit higher than first anticipated, or maybe some of the other contracts come in a bit higher. Multi-contractor strategy to de-risk plant execution. So that's saying essentially they're getting more contractors or more organisations to help get this done on time and get it running, which costs more. And then you got higher spec materials, linings and equipment to reduce further maintenance. So look, good work looking at reducing maintenance, but you would think a operation like this, world class, would have had high spec material from the start of the project. I would have predicted, but maybe not.
And hence Gina offering a helping hand.
Yeah, maybe. You wouldn't want a cost cut on a 4 million tonne per annum plant with a high ramp-up risk. So.
No, absolutely not. And all the indications that we'd heard were that they weren't, that they were, you know, developing something really world-class.
Yeah, so look, I guess where's the funding coming from? It's, look, could be, by the numbers, could be 350 to 450 million. They did state in there that, in the announcement, that they're in advanced discussions with a syndicate of commercial banks and government credit agencies to obtain funding it requires through to the expected generation of positive cash flow. So I assume that non-binding proposal from those three export credit agencies falls under that. If you think of the funding gap as a function of who takes ownership of Liontown, I guess, remember, Albemarle's bid is non-binding at this stage. They've commenced a four-week due diligence period that started 11th of September, so we'll have to wait before mid-October before there is potentially a binding proposal submitted by Albemarle. They then have to prepare the scheme of arrangement booklet, submit that to court, have all the shareholder votes and have the court approve it. So time frame on that, if you look at the develop essential scheme of arrangement as an example, the binding agreement was announced on 3rd of July and the implementation date, which is when the deal is finalised, is 27th of October. So that's 3.5 months for that process. So the actual vote, the scheme vote, where the shareholders vote, is 2 weeks before the implementation date. So if Albemarle put a binding proposal in mid-October and after their DD is done, and they'll have to get Foreign Investment Review Board approval as well, not sure if that'd be done in parallel or not, it could be February or later until that scheme is implemented. And if Albemarle did take control, Albemarle could offer a debt facility or something for the funding gap.
Yeah, we've seen that before where the buyer offers the target of some sort of facility, and it's worth bearing in mind, it sounds like a big number, it is a big number, but relative to the size of the company, it's less than 5% of the current market cap.
Yeah, so it's 5% of the transaction really for Albemarle would be that 5 or so in that debt facility. So look, we talked about Gina Rinehart the other day. We always just say Gina, but if, for anyone that doesn't know, Gina Rinehart, if you don't, you've been living under a bloody rock. Now, she has now 10.69% of Liontown, but there was another about 1.5% traded the other day, but the substantial change in substantial hasn't come out yet, so not definitively known it was her, but we're leaning towards it. So if you look, based on that timeline, Gina could keep accumulating Liontown shares for pretty much the next 3 months before that scheme vote. So whether they put a binding proposal in or not, she can keep buying shares. And look, we've seen what that sway is for the influence on the scheme vote with Gina's holding. So look, what's the play, JD? You mentioned it yesterday. What the fuck's she doing now? Why didn't she buy them all at $2.20 or something?
Yeah, exactly. We said it yesterday and I just want to say it again. Why did it take 6 bids from Albemarle for Gina to decide that she was really interested in this one and she's gone all out? Why didn't she make that decision, you know, a bit over half a year ago and pick the thing up at a market cap of half of what it is today? It's really interesting.
Are there some external pressures and forces, or
who knows?
Scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, you know? Who knows? Look, is she looking to partner with Albemarle? Is she looking to vote against Albemarle? And I guess the third one, which links to our first story, will Chris Ellison and Min Rez become a player alongside Gina?
Yeah.
It's heating up, Jada.
Yeah, if anyone can
get them. This is heating up.
If anyone can get them on the show, you know, the invite's open. Gina, Chris, come on.
We'll just have to check the schedule first. We'll try to fit them in.
Exactly.
We are pretty busy.
Let us know what the go is. Hey?
Yeah, I'm looking for this. There's plenty more to play out here. JD, ACG SPAC deal collapses.
SPAC, our favourite kinds of deals.
Is this the last of the SPACs?
Our very favourite kind of deals. A private equity group selling to a SPAC company.
Oh, don't buy anything off private equity, especially if you're a SPAC.
Yeah, and don't get involved if you're a SPAC. So, yeah, we spoke about this 1 or 2 months ago, Maddie. They, with the backing of Glencore and Stellantis and Volkswagen, as well as La Mancha, a group we've interviewed in the past, were looking to buy two mines off Appian, so Appian being the private equity. So the mines were Atlantic Nickel, which is a nickel sulfide mine, and MVV for short. That's a copper gold mine, both in Brazil. So word on the decline, Maddie, is that the buyers weren't happy with the price that they'd agreed and they wanted to pay a bit less. There was also a capital raising that needed to be done in tandem with this, and apparently there just wasn't much interest in any of the uptake. There were rumours of 300 odd million that needed to be raised and it wasn't sort of working. So the clear indication for why this hasn't worked is that the nickel price has just not performed well year to date, a bit more than year to date now, and the outlook isn't great either. I mean, I don't think we've had too much positive to say about nickel in the last few months. It's looking tough.
They haven't had anything to say. They've escaped the news a bit, nickel.
Yeah, and I mean, with sort of good reason. We spoke earlier in the year about Poseidon. Obviously, we spoke about the Mincor deal, and the sort of consensus is that it's in a really tough spot. You've got a lot of supply coming on from Indonesia. So Appian will be extra frustrated. They'd actually agreed to sell this asset last year to Sibanye-Stillwater, but that deal fell over as a result of geotechnical events, which we spoke about with the La Mancha group. They'd gotten comfortable with that risk. So there's actually a lawsuit that's ongoing, Appian frustrated at Sibanye, and they're going into legal proceedings to try and perhaps get some sort of settlement for them leaving that deal. So no doubt that a second deal falling over will irk them quite a bit, and I think it just really emphasises nickel is not in a good spot, and Appian might have to work a bit harder to try and find a suitor for these assets.
No better example of it. LPI, Lithium Power International, response to media speculation. They had a bit of a tear up 30% yesterday, JD.
Mate, they did. And, I mean, if you look from a couple of days ago to now, they're up over 50%. So that's quite the rise. We actually spoke about Lithium Power not too long ago. They had a wholly owned subsidiary called Western Lithium who'd sold tenements all around Greenbushes to Albemarle. So they'd picked up $30 million in cash as a result of that transaction. So their focus then switched to Chile. They do have other tenements around Tabba Tabba and Pilgangura, but their main focus was on Chile, and they have the Maricunga brine project in some of the salt flats in the Andes there. So
that's not in the lithium triangle.
Sure is, mate.
Oh, that's in the lithium triangle.
Yeah. So LPI, they not too long ago released some quotes and some wording in and around the stance that the Chilean government has on lithium, because there was a huge fuss, I believe, in April of this year, Maddie, with Gabriel Boric, the newly elected left-leaning president of Chile, looking to, you know, quote-unquote nationalise the lithium industry. So the reaction was a bit overblown. They weren't actually looking to nationalise it, although they were looking to get strongly involved. And they've got an example of this with Codelco being the state-owned copper mine company that you mentioned at the beginning of the show. So today's announcement is to do with Codelco entering a possible transaction with LPI. So no terms, nothing like that, just a response to media speculation.
So now will Codelco now become a national copper and lithium company, or is that – or spin out a Chilean lithium company?
It remains to be seen if they sort of start a – subsidiary that gets involved and eventually that sort of splits out on its own. It's very, very early days in this regard. I mean, they do have a giant lithium company, but not state-owned, SQM. We've spoken about numerous times. They've tried to buy Azure. They're in a big deal with Mount Holland with Wesfarmers. So, but again, not state-owned. So I'm fascinated to see what this deal looks like, because it's very rare that we speak favorably about a country looking to do something like what they're doing and, you know, the share price going up. We've spoken about West African nations where the government wants to get involved and pick up a stake and, you know, that's a big markdown on the stock, right? But here the reaction is if there's corporate M&A, and, you know, I think the most likely outcome is that LPI sell a stake of their company to Codelco, but there's not much to work from in terms of what a potential deal could look like. I don't have much to go off there. So, yeah, just really interested to see how that sort of shapes up and what the sort of price is, what the stake is, what the terms are.
Well, JD, you know we've made it. When we can get an ASX announcement come out, response to media speculation based on one of our word on the declines.
We are the media, Maddie.
We are the media. I'm probably at risk of it the most because I talk that much shit. Mate, back onto a bit of uranium. ISO Energy and Consolidated Uranium emerging.
Yeah, another one we've touched on not too long ago. The guys at Queens Road Capital, they are investors in ISO Energy, Warren Gilman.
Oh, so shout out, Warren. Good, bloody good episode, that one, if anyone wants to go back and have a look.
Yeah,
very
cracking
interesting
interview.
Interesting company. Don't lose Mr. Lee's money. Anyway.
That's the takeaway. So ISO Energy are merging with Consolidated Uranium. So the split is going to be 70-30 roughly once it's all consolidated. You might not have heard of these companies so much because they're both Canadian listed. So the joint entity is going to be valued at 900 million Canadian, so almost a billion Aussie, so not small by any means. And NexGen, who we have spoken about in the past, Natty, are actually the biggest holders in ISO Energy. So once the deal is done and they're merged, NexGen will own 34% of the combined group. Mate, I want to give you a fun fact.
What?
They have an indicated resource at their deposit in the Athabasca Basin called Hurricane of 48.6 million pounds contained at 34.5%.
Uranium. Jesus, I'd be interested to know if anyone's out there, let us know how you mine 34.5% uranium. Like, is it contained within something that it's not dangerous to workers if you do like inhale dust or something, if it's via drill and blast means? If anyone's got info on that, let us know. Like, how do you mine something that's 34% uranium? Is it a health risk?
Yeah, and one of the catches with this one, Matty, is that it sits substantially below the surface. So I believe this deposit sits at about 325 metres below surface.
That seems to be pretty common with those
Athabasca ones. Yep, so we've got Cigar Lake, you've got the Arrow deposit.
NexGen.
Sinks all the way down. Plenty other deposits, MacArthur River, all in this sort of similar style deposit.
Yeah.
So just to speak a bit about what Consolidated have, they have a number of previously producing mines that are now restart projects and a couple very famous ones, as well as a plant in Utah near Moab, which is a very famous historical uranium mining district. So, yeah, keen to see that. And we have spoken about uranium mergers in the past. We spoke about ACAB and Lotus not too long ago, but all these deals are starting to ramp up in uranium. I'm sure all the investment bankers are throwing term sheets at all the uranium companies who've seen the share price tear up recently. So we're going to be speaking a lot more about this.
We did, but I think Rick Rule interview was the first indication of like, right, I think uranium is going to be the next tear, because when he was talking, so he was very focused on it. We're like, right, we better start getting in on this shit. I wish I acted then. Right.
We also spoke about it with Warren Irwin in one of the very first interviews we did, Matty, and he was less bullish. He had seen, you know, he'd lived through and experienced the crazy bull market of 2007, and he didn't think this one would have quite the same impact on the uranium price. Not that he wasn't bullish uranium and bullish nuclear, but there's a lot of different takes out there. So we'll see where it goes.
Right, mate. Sovereign Metals, a bit more in Malawi. Geez, they're getting a bit of focus this week on Malawi. Pre-feasibility study for their mineral sands project, mate.
Mineral sands in Malawi. Who would have thought?
Mineral sands. Yeah, never thought of either, to be honest.
So Rio Tinto actually took a big chunk of these guys about 3 months ago, Matty. And to get into the PFS, some of the highlights: 25-year mine life, 222,000 tonnes of rutile per annum to be produced, as well as 244,000 tonnes per annum of graphite. So the scale is massive of this one. It is a huge, huge project over a sort of quite a vast landscape. And yeah, they've been developing it, Sovereign, for quite a while. So it was a big tick up that they got with Rio helping them out. And yeah, this is a PFS. It's still got a long way to go. They've still got to move on to the DFS. The scoping study came out, a revised scoping study actually, came out in June of 2022. So a bit over a year ago.
Much, much different. What's different in this one?
Very similar to every sort of difference between scoping and PFS, or PFS and DFS, that we've seen over the past year. As you'd expect, costs are up. So CapEx to first production was up 60% and the expansion capital was actually 8% lower. So they brought forward a few items, but overall costs had gone up. The IRR has gone down from 36% to 28%. Operating costs are 26% higher. So quite different to De Grey that we spoke about, where the CapEx went up but the operating costs didn't. Both went up here. The revenue over CapEx to first production as a bit of a metric went down from 4.1 times to 2.7 times. And just looking at the price deck, they used relatively conservative prices. So that I mean, that is a positive. The scoping study, this is a sort of interesting thing I picked up, was that they'd previously reported the payback period from the start of construction. They no longer reported that. What they did was the payback period from first production.
Okay, so they're making it sound a lot better because they're negating the whole time it takes to build it, which you don't usually see. It's usually payback from the start of the project.
You want to know from when you put the money in to when the money is fully paid back. That's what payback period should reflect. But what they show is payback from first production, and that's up from 2.6 years to 4.3 years. So you can imagine if it's a two-year construction period, it's quite a long payback period, given I did say they're using relatively conservative prices and whatnot. So I think
unless they've got a fucking sweet deal where we're like, we'll just pay you once it's done. I'd understand it then, but I'd highly doubt it.
I'd highly doubt that too. So all in, I think it's just reflective of the tough cost environment we're in that we've seen across the board the last year, Maddie. And to be fair to them as well, they did put in a sort of chunky contingency payment, which is conservative and what you kind of want companies to see so they don't have to go and rush to market and raise capital when they're sort of, you know, really, really needing it and in a not so good spot. So all that said, they're going to keep working towards the DFS and keep advancing the project.
Very good, mate. Now, Core Lithium's up 25% today on the back of their annual report. You rarely see big price fluctuations off an annual report because it's all off. All the data's already been out after the final quarterly of the financial year. So, JD, what's going on here?
Yeah, you're dead right. These guys did come out with a few new bits of info, but mining companies have to provide the quarterly, so you often have a good bit of insight prior to the annual report coming out. And they come out with a shortened update as well. So, like you said, the stock is up over 25%. That said, the company has had a shocking year, year to date, and a bit longer than that, really, since they've kind of gotten to production and been building the thing. It's been quite tough. They've raised over $100 million not too long ago, and they're still one of the most shorted stocks on the ASX. So they said that they'd sold some spodumene concentrate through a digital exchange platform.
Reminds me of the BMX platform that Pilbara were using for those 5,000 ton packets.
Yeah, and I wonder if we sort of start to see more of this kind of interesting. They sold about 15,000 tons, dry metric tons. So we spoke about Latin yesterday, Matty. You went into that one quite a bit. So to tie it in with Core do a DMS. They don't have the flotation. And just as it sort of relates to the type of product, we said you want a coarser grain spodumene material. And these guys were having issues with a finer grained thing, which makes life a bit harder to
lower, put it in lowers, simple terms. Lowers the recovery significantly, and the understanding I got given is that it wasn't drilled and defined enough to fully understand the fines distribution between the ore body.
Yeah, so, and they had 49% recoveries, yeah. I believe, last quarter. So it was, you know, exactly what you're saying, reflected in that, and it was sort of reflective of their strategy to just race to market and just get theirs as soon as possible, and you know, perhaps not understand things as well as possible and, you know, not have all the CapEx spent either. It's a sort of stage type thing as well because a lot of CapEx is yet to be spent.
And I don't want to say that fine-grained spodumene is the only thing that causes low recoveries. Like with the DMS side of things, if there's because it's based on size and density. So if there's similar material, like that, it might be half lithium, half barren or half gang, I think they call it, half lithium, half gang,
waste.
It might get treated as waste if it's sort of intertwined together. Like if there's similar mineralogies that are similar to the lithium, the dense media won't detect whether it's lithium or waste. So it is mineralogy dependent, but if there is that fine-grained spodumene because of the smaller size, it does get sent out to tail in a DMS, and that's when you do need float. But
And hopefully for the company's sake, they can get a better understanding of what they've got and work on those recoveries.
Call out to a GR or a MET that really wants to get into, especially looking at Mount Marion's an interesting one. We've always talked about how their spodumene concentrate is it's about 4%.
Yeah, 3.8 at times.
Yeah, which is one of the lowest spodumene concentrates, and it is a lot to do. It's hard to find info on it, but it's a lot to do with the mineralogy, because they haven't been able to get the flotation to work properly, is my understanding. So another little rabbit hole to go down. So
absolutely, keen to get into that one, Maddie. So just to round out Encore, they announced net profit after tax in the first year of $10.8 million. And post the year end, they'd said that 1,000 dry metric tonnes of spodcon, as well as 15,000 tonnes of lithium fines, were shipped. So they reiterated guidance of 90 to 100,000 tonnes of spodumene concentrate sales. So production was slightly lower for FY24. But yeah, I mean, they're not out the woods by any means. They've got a lot of work to do. Like we said, they've had poor recoveries. They've got a lot of capex that still needs to be spent. They raised a substantial amount of money, diluting the existing shareholders. And the C1 costs in Aussie dollar terms were $1,230. Puts them pretty high up on the cost curve. That said, at these lithium prices, they're going to be, you know, okay for a while, but they really want to work on streamlining and just driving in all those efficiencies to turn it into, you know, a lean machine that can withstand any sort of price environments.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the smaller lithium operations in Australia. Like, look, yeah. 90 to 100,000 tonne, Liontown's predicted to get to about 750,000. Pilgangoora's
P1000.
Well, that's ramping up to the P680 now, so that's going to be 680,000. Yep. Look, Greenbushes is 1.4 million tonnes of spod. So 90 to 100,000, it is a much smaller operation at the moment compared to what those bigger ones are pumping out.
Yeah, Mount Catlin gone for 230. So
yeah, it's probably on that end of the scale. So very good, JD.
Perfect, mate. Quite a busy Friday.
Oh, the weekend, mate. Money miners, stay tuned for Monday drop. Now it is a public holiday over East, but we've got one ready for you. Chill back in the bloody spa and knock back six beers, but probably not, because you want to take in this one. Very technical. We've got to
get your textbook out, write some notes.
We'll give it away.
No. We'll build the suspense, mate.
It's a great technical one on a great topic with a bloody expert in the field who has a nickname related to the topic that we sort of made up. But anyway,
perfect, mate.
Stay tuned for a Monday drop, Money Miners.
Couple sponsors to thank: Anytime Exploration, Terra Capital, K-Drill, JP Search.
I'll just say it if you remember them all. And bloody my bloody good mate, Marty Law at Smek Power and Technology, the electrical gurus. Thanks for all your support. Have a bloody good weekend, Money Miners. Enjoy the weekend if you're over East.
Hooteroo.
Hooteroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.